Welcome to The Craft of Preaching, an online conference hosted by Luther Seminary, October 5th through 7th, 2020. This workshop by Cameron Howard is titled More Than a Story, Strategies for Teaching the Bible's Poetic Texts.
And thanks everybody for being here this afternoon. We'll spend this hour talking about poetry, which I always find is a nice way to spend an hour. There aren't many hours in the day we get to devote to something like that. We're going to talk about preaching poetry. And so to do that, I'm going to start by talking a little bit about what poetry is, and particularly in the Bible, how you know where there's poetry versus prose, what's particular about biblical poetry. And I'll focus mostly on Hebrew poetry as an Old Testament professor and scholar, though we will have some opportunities to peek into the New Testament a time or two during our hour. So we'll talk about what is poetry, where is the poetry in the Bible, why is poetry different than other parts of scripture, and what then might we do about it? So I'll share my screen here and we will dive in. So first of all, what is a poem? Now, before I get started, let me say that there will be a couple of points in which I'll ask you to offer some responses in the chat, and then later in the hour, we'll have a chance to do some sharing orally if you would like, or in the chat. I just ask that if when we come to that part, if you would like to say something out loud, if you'll put an X in the chat, and then Ben will call on you in the order in which that X appears in the chat, so we can make sure everybody's voices get heard. Well, let's start outside of the Bible. Let's start with an English poem. Is this a poem? Well, I'm already going to call it a poem by Langston Hughes, so I'm going to say yes. But the real question here is, how do you know that this is a poem? So I'll read it out loud, and then you think about how you know this is a poem, and if you'll just put some of your ideas in the chat. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat? Or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode? How do you know that that's a poem? What, and this is a very like straightforward question, what are some of the indications that you're working with a poem? Rhyme and meter, right? That it has, so first of all, it's got rhyme, right? Sun and run, meet and sweet, load, explode. Right, so not every poem has to rhyme, but rhyme can be an indication of poetry for sure. And meter, it has a sort of sense of rhythm and perhaps even a regular sense of rhythm. I haven't tried to scan this poem, but it certainly has rhythm, and meter then is a regular pattern of rhythm. So we can hear in the way that it sounds, that it sounds poetic. Imagery, condensed imagery, the really kind of vibrant metaphors of raisin in the sun, a sore that's festering, rotten meat, a syrupy sweet, the sagging of a heavy load. All of those are sort of tested out in the poem. What is a dream deferred like? And each one of those images conjures up a really kind of intense picture of what that might look like, and to try to understand that idea. There's a pattern in the language. So you have all of these possibilities tested out with these question marks, absolutely, and the short connected phrases. The format, that yes, it looks like a poem, doesn't it, on the page. There's a lot of white space on the side. Someone has pressed enter at particular places, whereas it's not a you know, otherwise you'd expect a paragraph to go across the page. And then I want to circle back to the comment about meaningful disruption, right? And that's a really good insight, because for this poem, and we're going to see this in Hebrew poetry, your patterns, your poetic structure happens according to an expectation. And then your attention is drawn to where that pattern is interrupted. So here you have all these questions, right? What happens to a dream deferred? And also, as we talk about the disruption of the pattern, listen for the intonation. All the questions make your voice go up, right? What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Does it fester and run? Does it stink like rotten meat? Does it crust like a sweet? And then here's the disruption, right? Here's a difference. Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. And that line doesn't go up, right? Doesn't have a question. It's a declarative kind of statement. And it's also lower on the page. I mean, it really connotes, you really sort of feel the physical sagging. Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. And then again, back to the pattern, but this time in italics, and back up like an explosion, right? Or does it explode? So it's a really beautifully crafted poem. So there's something about how it sounds, what it looks like on the page, the kind of images that it evokes, that suggests to us it's a poem. All right, let's look at this example. Excuse me a moment. Is this a poem? We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution of the United States of America. Well, we know that it's the preamble to the Constitution, but if you'll share in the chat, is it a poem? Why or why not? Maybe not a poem, but poetic. Oh, I like that comment I missed about the Langston Hughes poems about imagination. That's to answer the question. That's a great comment. Yeah, so maybe poetic. If we test it against some of the observations we made about the Langston Hughes poem, it doesn't have a lot of white space on the outside, right? No one's pushed enter. It goes all the way across the page. It's very declarative. It doesn't sort of draw our attention to images or metaphors. It has a kind of performativeness to it. That's a nice way to put it, conceptual rather than imaginative. It's telling us something, right? It's not sort of asking us to necessarily imagine something. It's doing something. We are ordaining and establishing this Constitution. It does have a kind of rhythm to it, though, doesn't it? It has a pattern of all these infinitives: to form, to establish, ensure, provide. So you can get a kind of rhythm to it. That's why in Schoolhouse Rock, if anybody learned the preamble with the song in Schoolhouse Rock, you can put it to music. Might not be a super great song, but it still lends itself to a little bit of rhythm there. But yes, it makes very kind of definitive statements. And you have some instinct about this, right? You read the Langston Hughes piece and you kind of know it's a poem. And we can name some characteristics, but we can add in there your own kind of sense of interpretation. And with the Constitution, with the preamble, sort of similar intuition that it may have some characteristics of poetic language. But, you know, by and large, this is prose. So when it comes then to Hebrew poetry or poetry in the Bible, how do we know that that's poetry? Well, a lot of these same characteristics we will see reflected in Hebrew poetry or biblical poetry, but biblical poetry also has a kind of defining characteristic, or a dominant characteristic, I would say. You can have Hebrew poetry without this characteristic, but you rarely do. And that characteristic is parallelism, the distinguishing characteristic of Hebrew poetry. And even if you've never called it this, I'm sure you have observed this, particularly in the Psalms, certainly also in the prophets, anywhere you've got Hebrew poetry, that the stanza or the line, the couplet really, set of two lines, will say one thing and then say it again, sometimes in a slightly different way. So here we have Psalm 24, verse 1. The earth is the Lord's and all that is in it, the world and those who live in it. And with some slightly different colors, I've put in parallel the different elements of the verse. So earth and world are synonymous, right? Pretty much, they're in parallel. The earth is the Lord's, and then is the Lord's is not repeated in the next line. There's a kind of elliptical connection there. That is, it's assumed, right? The world also belongs to the Lord, but the poem doesn't repeat that part. The world and those who live in it. And those who live in it is then in relationship with all that is in it. So this is parallelism. Sometimes it can feel a little bit like it's redundancy, right? You say one thing and say it again. But there are some other ways to think about how parallelism is working to make meaning in biblical poetry. There are different ideas about how to characterize Hebrew parallelism, but what has stuck the most is the very simple three types of parallelism that were identified by Bishop Robert Loth in the 18th century. And they are at once instructive, but also kind of inadequate. They don't quite get to the fullness of parallelism in Hebrew poetry. But I do want to share with you examples of those three types that he classified, because I do think they help to start to give us language to describe what's happening in poetry. And when it comes to trying to preach about poetry, or teach about poetry, sometimes it's helpful to have some language, right, to move past that intuition and into, well, how can I describe what's going on here? So Loth's first type was synonymous parallelism, and this is the most common, it's the most basic, right? Say one thing, say it again. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. Waters and floods can't quench, can't drown love. And then the pronoun whose antecedent is love. The two lines are, by and large, synonymous. The second type that Loth identified is antithetic parallelism, which, as it sounds, the two lines are basically opposites. So here in Psalm 1, the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. And here the order, at least in the English, is inverted, right? The way of the righteous comes second in the top line, comes the way of the wicked comes first in the bottom line. But still, the elements are parallel, the way of the righteous, and then the opposite is the way of the wicked. But notice also how something is happening here with the parallelism beyond simply saying the same thing and saying its exact opposite. By putting these phrases, the Lord watches over, in contrast with perish, will perish, right? There's a little bit of a claim being made there that the opposite of having God watch over you is to perish, right? So when we know that it's antithetic and that there are these opposites being drawn, sometimes it's instructive to then reflect on, well, what does the poem assume these antithetical ideas are, and what might that say theologically or otherwise? So the Lord watches over your way, or else the way will perish. And then a question in the chat, what does the word but serve? Well, interestingly, in Hebrew, the word for and the word for but are the same. And so it's simply a conjunction. And the translator has made the decision that this is an adversative idea. That's just the fancy grammatical way of saying it's but versus copulative, which is to say and, joining together or contrasting. So it's a kind of pivot to join the two lines. There's a conjunction there that's pivoting between the two lines, but it is up to the translator slash interpreter. Every translator is an interpreter and every translation is an interpretation to decide which conjunction in English is best serves the translation of this verse. Yeah, good question. And then the third classification of parallelism is antithetic. And for Loth, this was really a catch-all category. Sort of everything that doesn't fit into synonymous or antithetic can be called synthetic. But it was an acknowledgement that there's sometimes something quite different happening in the second line of a couplet, of a sort of pair of ideas in Hebrew poetry, than what was happening in the first. The Lord is king forever and ever. The nations shall perish from his land. So perhaps we would call it a kind of causative parallel, or there's something about putting these two ideas together that joins them, but there's more room to talk about what exactly is going on in that relationship. Now, in the 20th and into 21st century, an interpreter, James Kugel, has suggested that instead of thinking of these as purely synonymous or purely opposites, or, you know, just the sort of synthetic, whatever that means, to think about the two lines of a parallel couplet in Hebrew as A, what's more, B. That is, if we sort of dismiss them as being redundancies, as being exact parallels, exact synonyms, or exact opposites, then sometimes we can miss some of the subtleties of meaning that are introduced by putting two ideas in parallel. So, for example, these ideas of justice and righteousness. You know, in Greek, justice and righteousness can be the same word. In Hebrew, though, they are paired concepts, but not necessarily the same, right? You have two different words, mishpat, tzedakah. But you also, when you put them together, right, they're what's more, right? There's a kind of plus, a kind of addition or multiplication that's going on that's not captured by simply one word. So A, what's more, B is a good kind of rule of thumb for thinking if you're trying to analyze two poetic lines together that are in parallel. What does that idea of what's more, B give you? So here we have this very famous quotation from Amos: let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Well, justice, but what's more, righteousness. How do they complement each other? And then waters, what's more, ever-flowing waters, not stagnant waters, right? Not just any waters, but sort of these life-giving, ever-flowing waters. In addition to parallelism, Hebrew poetry can be studied with all of the characteristics that you learned in your high school English class about English poetry. Metaphor and simile, first of all. So metaphors, which describe one thing in terms of another. Similes do the same thing, usually with like or as. Simile is really just a subcategory of metaphor, describing one thing in terms of another. I have a couple favorites from Hosea chapter 10, for example. Israel is a luxuriant vine that yields its fruit. So what does it mean then for Israel to be a luxuriant vine that yields fruit, right? That's a very vibrant kind of metaphor. And then things get less flattering for Israel in verse 11. Ephraim was a trained heifer that loved to thresh, and I spared her fair neck. So another way of thinking about Israel there is a trained heifer in verse 11 of Hosea 10. Both these are metaphors, and so Hebrew poetry is full of these kinds of metaphors. An example of a simile would be from Song of Songs 2, as a lily among brambles, so is my love among maidens. A lily among brambles. So trying to understand one idea in terms of another, or maybe even more than simply understand, but trying to describe, trying to capture something that's difficult to describe in sort of straightforward language about one thing with these metaphorical ideas. Hebrew poetry also has rhythm. If you took Hebrew in seminary, I really encourage you when you want to preach or just read a Hebrew poem to read it out loud. And it doesn't have to be perfect. No one will be listening, and I'm not suggesting you do this from the pulpit. But if you can sort of muster some of that Hebrew knowledge to pronounce the words out loud, you can hear a kind of rhythm to it, as well as sound play in the words, alliteration or assonance. So alliteration is the repetition of consonant sounds. Assonance is the repetition of vowel sounds. My go-to descriptions or examples of alliteration or assonance come from Dr. Seuss. Dr. Seuss's ABC, big A, little A, what begins with A, Aunt Annie's alligator, A. There's your assonance. And then big B, little B, what begins with B, Barber baby bubbles and a bumblebee, right? The repetition of those B sounds is alliteration. And you can hear similar kinds of repetition in the Hebrew if you read it out loud. Does, however, Hebrew have meter? This is actually a contested idea in scholarship around Hebrew poetry. Did Hebrew poets, ancient Hebrew poets, compose their poems with a regular pattern of rhythm? In my opinion, the evidence is not convincing that there's rhythm present there, but that no one had sort of like iambic pentameter, you know, Shakespeare's short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long. That you don't really see that in Hebrew, those kinds of regular patterns. But some scholars say that you do. So that's an open question. There's repetition in Hebrew poetry. You get repetition as a characteristic of Hebrew narrative as well. Parallelism itself is a kind of repetition, perhaps, but there's also repetition of key words throughout a poem to kind of draw the poem together. So you can be on the lookout for key kinds of repetitions. Hyperbole, exaggeration, Micah 6, you know, it ends famously with Micah 6:8. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with your God? But there's a real crescendo in that particular poem of frustration from the human respondent to God, who says, "With what shall I come before the Lord?" Right? Thousands of rams, 10,000s of rivers of oil, fruit of my body for the sin of my soul, right? Human sacrifice. And so there's that 10,000 rivers of oil would be a kind of hyperbolic statement, you know, probably that's not really what's required, but there's this, it's expressing a kind of emotion and frustration with these requirements from God in that conversation. And then finally, I'll mention acrostics. Acrostics are a relatively common or a recurring, I should at least say, structuring device in Hebrew poetry. The Book of Lamentations is one of our clearest examples of acrostics as a structuring device. So the poems in chapters 1, 2, and 3 are acrostic poems, each one beginning with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So first stanza begins with Aleph, the next stanza with Beit, next stanza with Gimel. And then chapter 3 is a triple acrostic. So you have three stanzas that begin with Aleph, and then three stanzas that begin with Beit, etc., all the way down to Tav. And there are psalms that do this. It's a popular kind of way to structure a poem, kind of a built-in structuring device. And what's remarkable about Lamentations is that in that fifth chapter, it has 22 stanzas, but the lines get really short and the acrostic starts to break down. And it really, in its structure, reflects the breakdown of hope and the breakdown of Jerusalem that's being described in the Book of Lamentations. So the very structure of the poems of Lamentations itself reflect the kind of despair and even hopelessness with which the poem ends. Or the poem, you know, Lamentations 5 ends with the possibility that God has utterly forsaken us. And so it's a good example, too, of remembering that Hebrew poetry has literary merit, as does Hebrew narrative. It was fashionable, particularly in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in biblical scholarship, to think of Hebrew poetry as and narrative as somehow primitive, that some of the repetitions, for example, or ideas in Hebrew poetry that we observe were not examples of good craftsmanship. And I think that just there's nothing further from the truth. And so Hebrew poetry is worth reading on its own terms in terms of its literary merits, not to mention, of course, its theological and biblical authority merits that also come with it. Where is the Bible's poetry? This is just a really quick review, but just to remember where we might find it. So the Psalms are all pretty much, well, all, period, poetry, except for their superscriptions. You know, they have lines that begin them that might give some instruction, you know, to the leader or the Psalm of David, that sort of thing. Proverbs, Song of Songs, that is Song of Solomon, and Lamentations are poetic books. Most of Job is poetry, except for the prose prologue and prose epilogue. Much of the prophetic material is poetry. Most of what you find in the 8th century prophets, Amos, Micah, Hosea, and 1st Isaiah is poetry. But in Ezekiel and Lamentations, we find a lot of prose. Still, though, the oracles themselves tend to be poetry. So prophetic oracles tend to be poetry, but then they're often surrounded by kind of prose narratives about what the prophet's doing, or, you know, for Jeremiah, the kind of political circumstances in which he's prophesying, that sort of thing. And, you know, the prophet says, as poets, we'll talk about a little bit more about what that means in the rest of the hour. Suffice it to say right now, I think it's no coincidence, no mere coincidence, that the prophets are poets, because prophecy and poetry really do go hand in hand. They complement each other. But we should not forget that we can find poetry embedded within the prose narratives of other books. For example, Exodus 15, the Song of the Sea, that Moses sings after the deliverance from Egypt, and then Miriam and the women also sing a song. And those songs are poetry. Poetry and hymns or songs are always in close relationship, and often poetry can be sung as a hymn, and songs can often then be written out as poems. We also find little snippets here and there, tiny little lines of poetry within the prose of the Bible. And many translations will set these little lines as poems. So again, looking for that white space where somebody's pressed enter before you might expect. As I make my way back to Genesis 1, turn to Genesis 9, which has a couple of little bits of poetry in it. Genesis 9:6, for example, whoever sheds the blood of a human, by a human shall that person's blood be shed, for in his own image God made humankind. The NRSV sets that out as poetry. largely because of its kind of parallel structure. But going all the way back to Genesis 1, verse 27, this is on the sixth day, God has said, let us make humankind in our image. And then after God finishes saying that, the narrator says, so God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And so there's a lot of really interesting